friends. This is Dr. Michael Williams, and welcome back to another episode of the Diversifying Path podcast. This podcast explores how investing in diversity can lead to a higher return of investment in pathology and laboratory medicine by learning from the knowledge and experiences of diverse voices within our field. My next guest is Dr. Terry Mason. Dr. Mason is currently a PGY4 AP-CP resident at the University of Louisville School of Medicine. She will be starting a year-long fellowship in surgical pathology at Oregon Health and Science University in the summer of 2022. Her professional interests include gynecologic pathology and diversity and inclusion work. She receives her medical degree from the University of Louisville School of Medicine and a B.S. in biology from Prairie View A&M University. Growing up, she always had a passion for both science and human interaction, and dedicated herself to a career in medicine in hopes of helping others heal their mind, body, and spirit. She currently serves as a member of the Graduate Medical Education Quality and Safety Subcommittee, member of the Undergraduate Medical Education Anti-Racism Task Force, and co-chair of the Resident Trainee Committee of the University of Louisville Cardinal Anti-Racism Agenda. In addition, she serves as a mentor to those interested in medicine. During medical school, she was very involved in SNMA and numerous pipeline education programs. Having struggled with self-esteem, body image, and mental health issues since childhood, she uses her experiences to help others and encourage dialogue to decrease stigma. In her free time, she enjoys spending time with loved ones, reading, traveling, writing, and capturing the beauty of the world via photography. Without further ado, here's Dr. Terry Mason. Hi again, friends. This is Dr. Michael Williams, and I'm back again with another episode of Diversifying Path. I am here with my next guest, Dr. Mason. So can you tell us who you are, where you're from, and your pronouns?
My name is Dr. Terry Mason, and I am a PGY4 at University of Louisville School of Medicine, and I hail from Dayton, Ohio. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I am headed to Oregon Health and Science University next summer for surgical pathology fellowship. I have an interest in gynecologic pathology and general surgical pathology. I have a passion for diversity, equity, and inclusion work, and increasing the amount of minorities that are in the medical field, whether it be a physician or a nurse or a lab tech, but just increasing the numbers to make sure that everybody has equitable health care. And I just love to meet new people, learn their stories, share their stories. One of my hobbies is photography, and I think that allows me to show people what I see in others and in candid interactions. And so I'm a person that loves path, loves people, and just loves life just in general.
All right. Yes, sis. Love it. And I was wondering where, how did you get involved with pathology actually?
I actually took some extra time to study for step 2 CK. And one of my friends that was going into pediatrics was like, you should take this peds path rotation. I saw her post on Instagram, her little microscope, and we hadn't done anything like that since histology back when we were first year medical students. And so I was like, okay, I'll take it. And I absolutely loved it. Everybody in the pediatric pathology department and the children's hospital was phenomenal. We got to do frozen sections. And there was also one of the pediatric pathologists has a interest in renal. So we actually have electron microscopy. So I got to see some EM, like on some platelets for platelet disorders mm-hmm. for young children. And just to see everything that happened during the day, we got to see, like, whenever you see studying for step one, like Hirschsprung's disease. Well, we got to rule out Hirschsprung's. So those rectal section biopsies, we got to view those. Nice. Or during frozen section to see where, you know, it went from aganglionic to ganglionic so we could stop the surgery. So this child could have normal functioning bowels as much as they could. And I didn't realize that pathology encompassed so much, and everybody just seemed really happy in what they were doing in the day-to-day. So after that, I decided to take some more electives, and right in the beginning of, I guess, the end of my third year, I decided to switch to path. And I was going to apply for internal medicine pediatrics because I like both adult and childhood, you know, diseases. So in a way, PATH allows me to do both of those. So it was one of the best switches I could have ever made. And it seems like every PATH rotation I took after that, I loved it even more. So that's how I knew it was right for me.
Yes. And I think we were talking earlier, like before the recording, that you have like the passion that you have, the way that you're just so passionate and discuss issues. It's like the advocacy, like energy of like a internal medicine, family medicine, primary care physician, but who's in pathology. And I was just saying like how amazing that is, because I feel like once you go into pathology, you're seeing patients depending on the subspecialty that you're in, but then to have the flame, I guess, to be lit, to have the advocacy, yeah, to be like, there's other stuff that we can also work on too, like, it was really all aspiring in my aspect. So that's why I wanted to bring that up. Where did this, in terms of, let's go back to being in DEI, how did you get involved with that?
I went to Prairie View A&M University for undergraduate, which is like a medium-sized historically Black college in Texas. And I feel like I got a really strong foundation in who I am and my history, and in the confidence to be proud of who I am no matter what field I go into. And that translated to my love of medicine and health. And when I did the summer medical and dental education program, SMDEP, which is now called, I think, SH Prep. It's changed over the years. It's sponsored by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And it was a 6-week summer program for pre-med and pre-dental students to stay on campus and get to experience and shadow physicians and also learn about the health field and talk about, I guess, introduction to that. Like, this is kind of how you get there. Because for me, I always knew that I loved health and I love medicine and I'm an active person. So I knew by doing medicine, I could be on my feet. I could be moving around. I could be talking to people. And that seems to be the perfect field for me. Just seeing the need, you know, in the community when we did a lot of community work during that, and just meeting the physicians and what they did in the community was like, oh, this is exciting. So I can both, you know, do my work in my day to day, and that could also translate into what I do in the community, because I always did community work even as a child. Being involved in the church, my grandmother would always have us feeding the homeless, or, you know, doing Thanksgiving dinner, you know, serving Thanksgiving dinner. Mm-hmm. So I just always had a love for giving back to the community and being involved. And so seeing that in the program encouraged me to still apply for medicine, because I had better tools to know what the process was, because I had nobody to help me. I don't have any doctors in my family, right, or anybody around me that was really, you know, could help me. And so they really stayed connected to me after that. I feel like University of Louisville had a really kind of strong program that once you're connected to the university and once you show that interest, and they provide you with the tools and the people to help you get to where you want to be. So that's why I stayed in contact. I also did the MCAD DAT summer program that they had. So I went back again the following summer to study for that. And I just loved the city so much and loved the people so much, I wanted to apply. And that was my first choice for medical school. And that's how I ended up at the University of Louisville. And so as I saw that the support that I had, I feel like had I gone anywhere else because of the difficulties that I had throughout my training process, I wouldn't have survived and I wouldn't have made it. So I have a great respect for the people that do their jobs and make sure that students are given the resources and support that they need to succeed, regardless of their background and regardless of, you know, any obstacle that comes along during their training process. And because I like to share with people the joy I felt when I knew that the degree was mine. I took that feeling, like all the years of frustrations and failing board exams and wanting to quit. And at one time, you know, contemplating suicide, you know, after failing step one and not sure if I was able to recover from that, and feeling that my career was over, because I just, you know, people put such a big emphasis on it. But having that MD and knowing that people support you, but I did that. I had the capability. I did it. That feeling, I can't compare it to anything else. And that I'm so thankful to be where I'm at. So that's why I'm so passionate about making sure people have the tools and support that they need, no matter where they're at. If they just need to talk to somebody, if I tell somebody, like, give them my email, tell them to call me, because it's so worth it to make it to the finish line. And so if I'm able to be a person that can help in that process, I always will, because I'm thankful to be where I'm at because of the people that supported me. I want to be that person for others.
Wow.
Because I'm happy where I'm at, and I'm thankful to be where I'm at. So you know, if anybody ever needs anything, it's a long process, and you need support. You can't do it by yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, with all the other societal pressures, you know, it's just like, if you can see somebody to know that, hey, I can do it too, then that makes it all worth it.
In medical school, it was definitely, it was difficult to continue on, especially when it's, when you feel like it's you versus the world. And for different people too, because I know I had those struggles as well, where I didn't know, like, what was happening and what was going on, and, like, is it worth it? Should I continue on? And eventually we are where we're at now through the struggles. And that makes us more reflective of where we are at and where we eventually hope to go, and incorporate more of things that they're not failures. They're just ways of how are things being presented and how can we process it so that we can make ourselves stronger for it. Now, you did talk about the struggles in medical school. Did you want to elaborate further in terms of what struggles in medical schools did you had?
And I think we talked about that a little bit before, is that I think the frustration is that nobody talks about it, is that numerous people have struggles with health issues, with family issues. I mean, just because you're in medical school or professional school doesn't mean that life is not going to happen to you. And so in addition to the stress of everything happening, you know, you have issues with school. So for me, when I had when I had to retake a year, I had people who pulled me to the side and said that I had to retake a year. And this is what was difficult for me. These are the resources that I did. If you ever need encouragement, if you're upset or whatever, if you need somebody to study with, do that with me. And I think that's really what helped me get through, is that people were brave enough to share their failures with me and to see where they're at now. Mm-hmm. And I think because it feels so taboo, because it's like, it doesn't happen. So I know for us, it's just like, you know, the day that your step one scores are released, if you get an email by student affairs early before like noon, you know that you failed. And I know I was on my OBGYN rotation and I got the email and I knew that I had failed. Just the amount of emotions and stuff that you feel afterwards, and knowing that I had people that I could talk to, made a world of difference. But it's just like, it makes you feel like the world is over. And the fact is that people have failed the exam and they've done well. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's a hurdle. Yeah. It's things are going to be a little bit more difficult, but it's not the end of the world. But because nobody talks about it, or they say that, you know, you just can't do it, just don't do it. Like, it's if it happens, it's going to be the worst thing ever. In your mind, it becomes this big elephant, when it's not a big elephant. There's things that you can do, and there's so much for your third and fourth year to develop and get better. You know, and there were people who passed step one, did well, but failed multiple shelf exams. I always did well on my shelf exams. Mm-hmm. So it's just like, it's a matter of how people talk about failures and what you can do to recover from them. So I also took a year off. I was struggling with issues with sleep, and I just wasn't feeling like myself. So I knew that I had struggled with mental health problems, and so I had sought counseling at the school. And so I had, you know, a psychiatrist that I would see there, because I had existing problems, and I knew for me it was important that I maintained as much of, I guess I kind of kept the rein on my mental health issues and depression and things like that. But I also started to have health issues that I didn't know what was going on. And, you know, with the stress of medical school, it brings out everything. So throughout testing, I realized that I had ADHD. You know, some people will take, you know, the hidden culture of taking stimulants, which, or, you know, over caffeinating yourself and things like that. But I actually paid the additional money to get the testing to see what are all these things going on. And so I was diagnosed with ADHD. I actually had a sleep study before, and it said that I did not have sleep apnea, because I have a strong family history of sleep apnea. And I was wondering if that was why I was so tired and I couldn't stay awake in lectures, even when I was at home and listening to pre-recorded. I just had really difficult time focusing. So I took the time to get healthier, lose some weight, and do some other things. And when I got back, I felt, you know, energized to, you know, hit it hard. But I still noticed a couple months after I returned that I was still struggling. I had a repeat sleep study, this time with the MSLT, and I was diagnosed with narcolepsy. And actually, starting medication, it felt a world of difference. I didn't know that I was such a chronically sleepy person. It was like I was a zombie all the time. And once I started to become medicated, I was just like, is this what it's like to be a normal, functioning, awake human being? And it made all the difference for me, that small change. So the medication also helped me to manage some of my ADHD. So it was just like, I'm functioning a lot better, just not just from being a medical student, but just as an adult in my daily life, from grocery shopping, from maintaining bills, from doing different things. It made a world of difference for me. And it seems like just the stress of medical school kind of pulled all of these issues out. And so it was hard for me to have to retake step one because it put me behind. For me, having to take a year off, it put me behind. So I didn't get to graduate with a lot of my classmates. And, you know, when you're starting out with a new class, that's difficult. And then also, you know, when you apply to residency, it's a lot of pressure anyway. And there's a lot of, even though you're in it all together, once you get to medical school, once you get to professional school, everybody has the same goal. You're going to get the degree, you're going to practice. You know, it's somewhat competitive for certain things, but we all pretty much have the same goal. But it seems like it can be kind of a nasty undertone in terms of, well, you failed, or you're not going to, you should just apply. Some people told me to just apply to family medicine or to dual apply. And I knew I wanted to do PATH. So even if I had to apply to all the programs, I was going to do what I had to do. But I knew that I had worked hard in my rotations and that I had strong letters. And I just prayed and I hoped that, you know, that people would see the whole package. And that's what happened for me. And that's what I'd like to share with other people. Even though it seems really dark, just know that, you know, you have a failure, but don't allow yourself to get stuck in that mode. I know that for every rotation, I worked my butt off. You know, if I had issues, I tried to confront them, you know, first off. But it's hard because you have to constantly encourage yourself and let you know you're not a failure. You have failed some things, but what are you learning from it? How can you get better? And also surrounding yourself with people who support you in that process. And like I said, the thing that's made the difference for me is that people share their experience with me to let me know that I'm not alone, that this happened to me and I'm okay. Mm-hmm. And it's not the end of the world, you know, and because people will gossip, just like with everything, there's people in medicine that gossip and, you know, we'll share things, but ultimately having that support made the difference. But, you know, I went through health problems. I went through taking a year off. I went through failing step one. I also failed step two CS and, you know, applying for residency, not sure what's going to happen, you know, what's going to happen for me and just, you know, going for it. I'm so thankful that I did. Like I said, once I finished that, and I think there's always challenges. I got stuck in that cycle of, well, what's next? What's next? What's next? Right. And I think having had health issues in residency, I realized that it's enjoying my day to day. I love what I do every day, and just being able to be my healthiest self to present to people is what's important. Is that there's always going to be a next step, but in my day to day, being happy where I'm at with what I'm doing is kind of like what my focus is. And I've, you know, the moments where some rotations just haven't gone as well as others have, but okay, well, what can I do to be better? You know, and right. It's just not the end all be all, but what kind of physician do I want to be?
I don't want to step back because in terms of like that relation with medical school, like I think, but I had to repeat my first year too. Like I had to repeat a year coming into medical school as a non-traditional student, coming from an engineering background and learning to do things for me logically. And then trying to find a way to transition to learn to do well in medical school. Like histology honestly was probably mm-hmm. for me the easiest class because like it was like pictures and images, like the image, like mm-hmm. images made so much sense to me. I was like, oh wow, like this is it. But yeah, so I repeated the first year and I remember that feeling of just, you know, being lonely and not being able to, you know, my classmates are going on like and going on to second year, I'm basically stuck in my first year. And like that whole process in itself of repeating the first year, and like I had a fight for not staying in medical school, but there was like a thing I had a committee I had to meet, and that's a whole different story. But like that's a whole different story. But to, you know, see your classmates go forward and then being stuck again in the same situation where I was basically like, okay, this new student is coming in and like I don't know what's really going on, and like feeling people are going to be talking about me behind my back in front of my face, like, oh, that's that kid who like had to repeat the first year. And you know, let me just, for those who are non-medical or maybe in professional in different professions but kind of can relate, and you know, when you're stuck in a curriculum in classrooms with the same people like for the first like 2 years or whatever years that you're training in terms of mm-hmm. that profession, and you're with them, like you get to see the good and bad of the people that you're with, you know, like, and that's in a very like structured, high pressure, I'm gonna say arena, because in a way we're always competing for something. Mm-hmm. And you get to see all that, and like you're just like assuming the worst all the time, because you're just like, oh my God, like, is this person looking at me because they, you know, hurt or think I'm a failure and stuff like that? And you just, you know, continuing on. So, like, that discussion and what you brought up, I was just like, wow, like, I feel that, because in a way I felt the whole thing of like repeating a year and like, you know, that devastating act of like repeating a year and like, how do you tell your family? Like, do you even tell your family? And like, am I a failure? And progressing to the point where I think, I don't know, in residency maybe is when I started thinking about it. It was like, in residency, pathology residency. Let me clarify, pathology residency. because I did a year of surgery, and so it was, there were some things there as well, too. But, like, you get the social awareness of yourself about what you can mm-hmm. actually do, and you have a support system that builds you up and not breaks you down. So I completely was like, wow, like, I agree. And for those who are, like, you know, medical students or even, who knows, anybody else who's listening who's feeling that way too, like, you're not alone. It happens. You know, you're not a failure in any way. You are a person who's just trying to figure out what's best for you. You know, take what happens, you know, getting in, and then basically say, okay, what's best for me? Because, like, if it's something that's unsustainable, don't try to exhaust yourself to feel like you have to compete with the person next to you. Basically do something to make you feel like you're, you know, doing well. So,
and as you say that, I think about and my friend Allie, who's doing neonatology fellowship in University of Washington. So it's, she, I think, Robert, she shared with me that she applied, I think, 3 or 4 times to get into medical school. So she had a lot of those frustrations. And I remember moving into her class, so I had to repeat my second year. So it was just like people that I really just didn't know, like, at all. Like, it had been, and for me, I actually got into University of Louisville, 5-year kind of conditional acceptance program. My MCAT score wasn't the greatest, and that's a whole nother story. But I wasn't really with my class anyway, so I felt totally removed from all the people that I had met. And I remember Allie just kind of, when I said that, like, kind of like in our Facebook group for our class, that, hey, I'm repeating and stuff, she reached out to me and was always really friendly, really supportive, with somebody that I could study with. Also, my friend Malia, that's doing poem and crit care at University of Virginia. I just, those people made all the difference when I wasn't feeling good about myself, when I felt insecure, when I didn't know anybody. They would always be like, hey, would you like to study with me? Hey, you know, would you like to, you know, come hang out with us? And for me, those few people really just made all the difference, because it's like, it's already hard enough that, you know, I feel sometimes that I have to prove that I deserve to be here because I'm Black. And people think that I, you know, and you hear, like, on, like, the old student doctor network back in the day when they used to talk about admissions, and they're like, oh, well, you're just kind of like a racial admit and things like that. So you're already thinking, are they probably accepting me just because I'm Black? So it's always I'm always constantly fighting the imposter syndrome. And then the fact that I did have to repeat the year, and I don't know anybody, and I'm already feeling insecure. But just the fact that I had a few of those people just to support me. So I say, if there's any moment where you see a person like that in your class, maybe you're the person that excels, just to say kind words or just to encourage. For me, that was what my savior was, because I was dealing with all of these, you know, self-doubts about myself, in addition to, you know, making sure that I do well. And, you know, so like, hey, I can do it, you know, all these things happen. So, you know, recovering from failure, but also having these other pressures and fighting this constant imposter syndrome of being, you know, one of the 5% in the class. So it made a difference for those people who reached out to me during those times. And I thank them to this day. And I'm still close to them to this day, because I think they understand the true meaning of what it means to be a colleague, to be a supportive colleague and professional connection and friend. And I'm so thankful that I have them now, because I would send anybody that I know to any of them for care. And I think that's just a testimony to who they are and who their spirit is. So I think that's been a huge support for me throughout the process, because you just never know what somebody's going through. You can see and then with social media, it's like, hey, I'll do all my highlights, but people, they never show the negative things. So for me, I've highlighted on my Facebook when I failed, and I've had people that have reached out to me, and I'm glad that they did, because sometimes you're just like, I feel like I'm the only person. And it's scary, because you worry about people judging you for when you share that I failed my step one, that I had to repeat a year, that, you know, everybody else got 10 residency interviews, 12, and I got 3, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's just like, you know, but it's not a competition, but I'm glad that I've shared. I think it was somewhat therapeutic for me to not feel like I have to hide that. and have all that just inside. And there's more people that have experienced it than you think.
I shared because this for me, I think it's therapeutic to not really, you know, go back and try to, you know, figure out, you know, why am I feeling this way, like in terms of taking standardized examinations or, you know, I took the boards and that brought back flashbacks of studying for step one and going through that in medical school and, you know, and trying to figure out the way to make sure like I'm doing well. So for those who know, because we're going to transition to mental health. When I was studying for the boards recently, like there was so much going on. You know, we had the unfortunate, you know, tragedy that happened with Dante Wright. We were still dealing with COVID. We were still dealing with the Capitol attack that happened on January 6th, and like seeing the stark difference that happens with those who are, you know, doing insurrection versus those who were doing the protest for Black Lives Matter. So there was so much stuff mm-hmm. going on. And I remember I got a therapist because I was like, there was so much stuff going on. I was afraid to drive.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I, you know, here I am. Like, if I drive and I look at a person, an officer wrong or do something, because I'm like, you know, the first thing they're going to see is a black guy. I don't know what's happening, regardless of where I was at. I mean, I'm in New York, but I don't care where we're at. Like, that's a constant thing that we have to deal with because we have to be super vigilant about our surroundings. But I did, and I got a therapist and talked about it throughout about things that were happening and what may be impeding my studies or things that I can do to make myself feel much more comfortable in terms of, you know, moving forward, because it was all that plus things that happened in medical school. But I bring that up just to say, like, yeah, this has happened to me. I'm a human person. Like, I'm human. I'm not going to sit there and hide and, like, everything was all perfect. It wasn't. But it happened, mm-hmm. and, like, I'm aware of it. And it's not something, like, I mean, I'm talking about it, like, here easily because it's not something I don't feel like needs to be hidden. Like, it happened. And I'm, like, anyway, dealt with it and dealing with it. And it's not something that is a weakness but a strength, I think. But I think I want to transition into talking about your role in mental health advocacy. Because I think you told me a bit about it, but I wanted to, you know, hear more about how you got involved with that and, like, where you're at currently with that.
I want to say that I appreciate our conversation about boards, because as you say that, it's always in the back of my mind because there's so much pressure about board exams, is that even when discussions with my program, even though it's almost a year away, the stress is there. I'm thinking about boards now. And for you to be like, you know, for me to see you and you seem so confident and to know that you're just like, oh, and you've had those struggles, it makes me feel better knowing that, you know, I can do it too. You did it, you're there. You know,
you can do it too, girl. You can always do it.
So it's just like, oh, it's just like, even though that was so long, and even though I did fine on my step three, even though, you know, it's been a little shaky on some of my in-service, depending on, you know, what was going on at the time. But it's just like to know that, you know, it's coming back for me for boards and they're not even, it's almost a year away, that thank you for, it makes me feel better to know that I'm not just freaking out for anything. But I think mental health, and I'm thankful to have a mother who was always open. My mother struggled with mental health issues. And as a teenager, I would see her where I would leave in high school to go to school. And I come back and she'd still be in her bed. She hasn't gotten up, you know, and she's dealing with those things. But when she noticed some of those same things in me, you know, at the age of 13, I started to see a therapist and I started antidepressants. And I've been medicated and I've seen a therapist on and off since the age of 13. So it was always something for me. I always seeked a doctor to see when I was in college to make sure that my mental health was, you know, maintained, because I know that I wanted to be successful. And I know that when it can kind of, when I don't take care of it, I don't do very well. So it's always been a push for me because my mother's been so open that I can talk about it. And that I've sought help, so I encourage others to seek help. So I did the same thing when I got to medical school. I was still on antidepressants and things like that, and I would see my psychiatrist regularly to make sure that my meds were regulated. And like I said, when I was having issues with concentrating and not being able to focus like I did before, and my doctor encouraged me to get testing, I made sure to pay for the testing to get that done, to get a sleep study done. But I think it's important to have a good support system and share whenever you're feeling really bad, because I remember when I left for my break, actually the physician who did my sleep study told me that not everybody is meant to be a physician and maybe I should think about other things. And it was out of line. And I remember being in a vulnerable position because I'm trying everything that I can. I'm speaking to all my doctors. I'm trying to do all these tests to make sure, like, what's going on. I want to fix it because I want to do well, and I don't want to fail out of school, and I want to be depressed all the time. I don't want to feel tired all the time. And there's this man that's telling me that maybe I'm just not cut out for it when he knows nothing about me. And I remember leaving that appointment and crying in my car for about an hour. And that's when I decided to take a leave of absence. At that point, I had reached my max of, I don't know what's going on, what's wrong. And they were like, well, I had always made sure to maintain that, to know with the school too, that I've always tried, you know. And I think that's important for people to seek help early and always have the record of that, because you need to take a mental health leave of absence, or for health reasons, when, you know, for sleep issues or whatever else, you know, because sitting in front of a committee for them to be like, okay, you can come back, you know, that's a scary thing. But I always made sure to document and do whatever I could within my power. And so that's what I encourage other people to do. It's scary, you know, depression and mental health or anxiety, it looks different for different people. And I realized that I had terrible test anxiety, terrible, terrible, terrible test anxiety. And so I've actually worked in therapy on with CBT and other things to help me kind of manage it. Cause I realized that I would have so much stress that I would go to read the test questions and they would blur. So I'd have to read the question two or three times over again. So that kills test timing. And realizing that you can also apply for testing accommodations with those things. And I think people always make it seem that, you know, cause you're in medical school, you don't need tutoring, or you know, I don't know, for some reason, it feels like it's just like, you should already, you know, be able to learn and be able to do those things. No, I had tutoring in med school. I, you know, did therapy to do CBT to work through my test anxiety, and I took medication. You know, I took the beta blocker because I realized my heart was pounding and I could hear my heart in my chest. I can't focus on my question. It's blurring. And so I made sure to try everything that I could. And I shared that with people, that, you know, I go see the doctor on campus, or I go to therapy weekly, or, you know, whatever it was. So for me, it's always been something that I made sure to maintain and try to keep a priority, because I know that it really affects my personal life as well as my professional life. Mm-hmm. So, and being African American, a lot of times people just tell you to stick through it. You know, even for my grandmother, as my mother's had to explain a lot to her about why I had to take my leave of absence, or for the moments when I'm frustrating, or even when I shared, you know, studying for step one and feeling like it's not really progressing like I wanted to. And thinking about, you know, taking a bottle of pills, because I'm like, maybe it's just better if I can't do this. It's so overwhelming because I failed. And people are like, well, if you failed, then you're not going to get into residency. I've only had one rotation of a third year. I did well in my shelf exam. And I actually, you know, despite learning that news, I still did well through the rotation, you know. And so that let me know that, hey, I'm supposed to be here. I'm supposed to do well. But there was this overhanging cloud of my worth in this test. And so for me, getting through that was what was most important for me to progress through the rest of my rotations. And talking about it, it helped a lot. And then that's when I learned that other people had had experience. And because I was vocal about it, I've done some talks online with some of my church members who do family counseling and therapy to talk about mental health and recognizing depression, recognizing anxiety. Because some people, they think that they have to be on medication forever, or, you know, there's a whole bunch of risk factors when it, you know, and different things that contribute to mental health. So I tell somebody that if they're depressed, you may just be acutely depressed, or it may be extended grief, or it could be different things, but to seek out help for that. So you may not have to be on medication every day for the rest of your life. Everybody's different. So I think people have these ideas of what mental health, what depression looks like and things like that. So I think for me, it's important for me to talk about, you know, group, having been in group therapy at some point in college, and how that experience helped me. Also, you know, the fact that now I talk to my therapist every Tuesday. I know, because of the stress of residency, having dealt with health problems that started during my first year of residency, that I have to maintain. So it's not just about medication, but it's giving myself the tools to deal with the day-to-day stresses, you know, of work as well as personal life. That's been important to me. And I think that's been valuable for me in my personal development, and my ability to speak with others, and also in my ability to relate with patients. And I share that in these, like, these online sessions, or whenever people want me to talk to medical students or speak on panels, I make it a priority to mention it, or to say that it's something that you should focus on and it should be important. And it's hard to talk about. People don't want to talk about that. But when you see so many people dying, or you see people suffering, or even, you know, I think it's important to just speak up or just to see, hey, how are you doing when you notice it in other people? Because some people just really just don't realize that's what it is, and they're trying to push through, and it's really hard.
I was going to ask about the chronic health issues, too, because I've seen on Twitter you posted about endometriosis and after the surgeries, and just wanted to have you talk about having chronic health condition, well, multitude, but general endometriosis. If you can discuss how your battles with that has been, from being first diagnosed and dealing with endometriosis now as a resident.
That's a great question. So I had the Nexplanon in my last year of medical school, and I remember I had a lot of side effects after the first 2 out of 3 years. I'd always had kind of like heavy cycles and things like that, and it's usually maintained pretty well through birth control. And I remember taking the Nexplanon out, and throughout the course of that year, I used to have increasing pain, increasing bleeding. I used to just have a lot of fatigue, and so I just chalked it up to this is what's normal. It was like, this is what's normal. You just kind of push through it. And I actually finished off cycle, so I applied for residency and finished in December. And so in the spring, I worked in a medical office, and I remember my symptoms were worsening, and I would have to be like kind of hunched over at work, and it would be, you know, difficult walking sometimes. And I'm like, well, you know, it used to be painful like this before, but maybe it's, you know, I'm taking a break from the next one on, trying to figure out what I want to do next. And it seemed to calm down for a little bit. And once I started residency in the fall, I matched, and then I started in the fall. I went to a new doctor as I got health insurance. Starting to see a new doctor, and it was kind of like, oh, it's just regular, you know, period pains, and we'll start you on birth control. And I knew that I had like a family history of fibroids, but I knew that from scans and everything that I didn't have fibroids, and there wasn't really anything else to explain. So I went through going to GI, going to all these different doctors, thinking that it's something else, or it's just the stress. But it got to the point, I remember I was performing an autopsy, and I almost passed out because of the pain. And I realized at that time I actually had bled through my scrubs. And there was another incident where I was working and I went to the bathroom and I peed gross blood and I freaked out. And then I was like, okay, I don't know what it could be. Just don't worry about it. It's just probably like a one-off thing, you know, cause I'm a generally healthy person. And then when it happened again later that day, I freaked out, and my attendings were like, just go to the ED. And I remember going to the ED and them referring me to urology, and I had a follow up, and that's a story for another day about when you're advocating for yourself and when they see things and how people treat you when you're a minority, regardless of your educational status. But pretty much a lesion was seen in my bladder, and it wasn't discussed and wasn't sent to my doctor and things like that. But I ended up having to go through an painful endometrial biopsy, among other things. And eventually I was just like, as a resident, I can't keep taking off work. This pain, like I said, I almost passed out during an autopsy. It was at the point where if I was previewing cases, I would have a heating pad on. I'd keep my heating pad at work with me. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, something's wrong. And they finally decided to do the diagnostic laparoscopy in May of my first year. And I realized I had stage 4 frozen pelvis. I had switched doctors because of some circumstances within the practice, but that was one of the worst cases that she'd actually seen. So I felt a sense of relief that my suspicions were confirmed. I was a little bit frustrated that it took me so long. As many women, it takes a long time for them to have diagnosis. But I had the initial, but she wasn't qualified to do the full excision, so I had to wait to go see a surgeon that could do excision, and that wasn't until September of the following year, or September after that, but dealing with trying birth control, but it wasn't helping. You know, at that point, it was gonna take me removing all of those lesions to have some relief. And the excision surgery lasted numerous hours, and it took me about 8 weeks to recover. And so my program was really supportive in helping me during rotations to be able to take the time to rest and recover. And I felt after that I didn't have pain. And so that was nice. I was living with daily pain. I'll probably say it was about a 5 out of 10. And when it was really bad, it was around a 7 out of 10. So I just tried whatever I could with, you know, over-the-counter pain meds. Like I said, I would take my heating pad with me to work. And it was just miserable. It was hard to focus. And I just, whenever I could sleep, I would sleep. But it was just I just got used to just suffering through the day. But I was like, I can't quit. I'm finally here where I need to be. So I just like, I got used to being in that mode of you have to do whatever it takes. So people like go home. No, I'm not taking extra time. I'm at work. I'm suffering. I might go lay down on the floor in the resident room for a while. But it was just frustrating. So luckily, I was able to, you know, reach out and find the physicians that need. And I remember reaching out to the surgeon within my network, and he was great. But I had a lot of support from my program. I think that's so great. Important. Like my department chair sent me chocolates and my co-resident sent me flowers. And so I think they would come by, and actually, I don't have family close by. And, you know, with, you know, sometimes with work issues, like I had them drive me to my surgery and they stayed with me at my house, you know, while I was on anesthesia and helping me with that. So having that support made all the difference. And I actually started to have pain again. And I realized that it was potentially a recurrence. And after my first surgery, I was advised to go, you know, for fertility assessment. And that's when I realized that my fertility was greatly compromised because of the severity of the disease. So at, you know, I'm dealing with the fact that I have this chronic disease, that I probably have chronic pain, that even a hysterectomy and it won't resolve it, you know. Mm. And then realizing that at the age of, I guess 31 at the time, that I might not ever be able to have my biological children. It's just like, I think that's the importance of having mental health there too, dealing with a lot of things that, hey, I'm finally in residency now. I'm excited. I love my specialty. You know, all that stuff that happened in medical school is behind. I'm in my zone. I'm doing well on rotations. Right. Like, I'm rocking it out. And then it's just like, I just keep getting hit. This pain, these surgeries, these medical bills, you know, having to take my vacation days for, you know, recovery. And then realizing that, hey, I feel like I've done things all the right way. And then I, you know, I probably can't have my own kids. And then trying to save money as a resident, say, can I afford to freeze whatever eggs might be there? Can I have the time to take off if I had to do that, because learning the process of that, that's daunting in and of itself, to at that point to do IVF, to have to do serial ultrasounds, to be on, you know, ovarian hyperstimulation, and the effects that could have on your mental health because of it. And it's just like, do I want to deal with all this stuff? But I know that my time is limited, but, you know, it's just like all of this stuff with work. So it's been a journey for me. And I think having a good physicians as well as a supportive program has helped me, and co-residents that support me has been integral in me finding ways to cope, also finding support groups, both online and also sharing my experiences, you know, in some of the community health groups, or whenever somebody's telling me that they don't feel good or something's going on, I'm like, well, go get it checked out. It may not, or it's not okay to have this much pain. I think I've learned a lot about patient advocacy through this whole entire process. Like I said, I mean, I had my mental health stuff, but when it came to, like, I don't know what's going on with my body, but I know this pain is, like, I'm almost passing out of work, and then I'm peeing gross blood, and then, you know, it hurt every time I used the bathroom. And I remember being scared, because when I had gotten my MRI after my initial diagnosis, when I could see the pictures when she tried to remove some of it, but seeing all of the lesions in my pelvis, seeing my ovaries stuck to my uterus, you know, and seeing even on the MRI that you could see lesions, and knowing that I might have to have a low anterior resection depending on the severity of disease. And I was like, I don't want to have an ostomy bag. And I remember waking up from surgery being so glad to not have, you know, an ostomy. But being scared, like, I might have to have a colon resection, like, all of this during residency, like, it's just scary. Right. Like, my body's just, like, giving up on me. And like I said, so I was pain-free, and then pain came back again. I had another surgery, and so far I've been pain-free. So I keep a close eye on it. And hopefully with both suppressive medications and that, but I'm still currently dealing with the conundrum of trying to save money to see if it's worth it to even attempt fertility treatments, because of knowing, you know, the low, you know, low probability of even for me yielding eggs at this point, but also of it's my last year. I know that I'm leaving for fellowship. And do I have the time? But also, I don't have the money, but do I want to go into debt for this? So it's been a journey, but I think I have had a lot of support between my family and my program. And they're always asking me, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Whenever I've been hospitalized, they come to see me, they've sent me flowers. Like, I think it's Like I tell people, like it's unreal. Like the support that I've had, I think that's made all the difference for me. So it's been scary. I think it was scary for me because I was worried that I would have to either extend my training or either I wouldn't be able to complete training at all to live, to think that I would, you know, live in with chronic pain. But I met other physicians that have dealt with other things. So it's a constant learning process for me too.
Right.
How can I live my healthiest, you know, in terms of weight loss, in terms of, you know, the side effects from, and I know I was concerned about even some of the suppressive medications that for endometriosis, because it can cause you to go into chemical menopause, and that can, you know, have issues with your mental health, as well as, you know, I can't sweat through my business clothes. I can't sweat through my sweats, you know, through my scrubs, you know, and that's unprofessional. I don't want to like have to work with, so I've struggled with that for a long time, to have to balance what do I do for treatment versus, you know, how can I function in my day-to-day professionally. So it's been a balancing act.
Is that what encouraged you to go the gynecological pathology search pathway for fellowship for you, is like these experiences?
I think so. I think I've had a lot of friends that have had issues. And it's funny, probably 2 years prior, I had a friend that had to have a hysterectomy early due to issues, and seeing what she went through, and also the knowledge that you get and knowing that it happens to a lot of women, and making sure that it gets diagnosed properly. I think that makes a huge difference. And it's funny because I tell people you see path. I was like, so I wanted to see my slides. So I actually have seen my slides from my surgeries and stuff like that. So it's like, it makes it real for me. You know, I think it's been interesting. And I think just the fact that these diseases have such a great effect on your life, even early on, and just promoting, you know, going to the doctor early, making sure that you're seen, making sure that you get proper diagnosis of lesions. Because I've seen where, you know, when you get consults for people and you're like, whoa, what's going on? Or how did this happen? And I think that's been, I think it has played a role in my interest in gynecologic pathology. But I laugh because I'm like, no, I want to see my slides. So it's to see the pictures, to see the slides. It just makes it even realer. I think that's what makes me love, I think kind of connects with the community health of me talking to people about, you know, health and volunteering, is that I tell people, like, I, you know, when people are like, what is this called colonoscopy for? They said I have polyps, but I can explain to my grandmother, like, what it means when you have a polyp and why you have to go, you know, in 3 years or 5 years versus 10 years. Mm-hmm. So it's for me to be able to explain that to people. They're like, oh, okay. And everything, had to be able to connect those dots. Because a lot of times people can't connect the dots between their diagnostic testing with their diagnosis and what that means. And so I love being able to have that knowledge to share and kind of give people that visual and that understanding of what that means for their body.
I do have two last questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about it earlier throughout our conversations about DEI. And I wanted to ask you, what is your thoughts about ways of increasing the amount of BIPOC into medicine and pathology?
Being involved with med students early. Because there's not, I mean, I would have not known how amazing pathology was until I had taken that pediatric pathology elective. So for me, I think it's exposing people to the specialty early, just in general for pathology. People just don't have, it's a gem. Like one of the gems of medicine. People don't know. And so having that early exposure early into your med school, first and second year, understanding like, oh, I just have to study pathology, and not really seeing the connection when you get to third and fourth year, because people still really don't understand, you know, and they really don't use microscopes anymore. You know, histology is all digital for most people, and understanding, you know, most people, they have like big groups for gross anatomy, but finding ways to make it more interactive and allowing people to spend more time, you know, in the pathology department, or having that, you know, connection during rotation to say, if your patient on your floor has this, come down and look at the slides, or come down and look at the PCR, or come look at your, you know, protein electrophoresis for your patient that you think might have multiple myeloma. Like, I think having those connections, but it also goes into pipeline programming as well. So when they have these programs for medicine involving pathology as part of those specialists, you know, having the pathologist out in the forefront. So when you see breast cancer, having the breast pathologist, having the gynecologic pathologist, having the genitourinary, having the neuropathologist understand, oh, okay, this is what's going on with my brain. You know, this is what's going on with my body. And it takes that early exposure. I know we understand just for it, you know, because of the historical racism and the way that society is, pipeline programs are what has made recruitment successful. So it's going to take early intervention and getting kids to see what we do in the lab. They're not exposed to laboratory medicine like that. Mm-hmm. Neither are medical students. But when we're talking about getting minorities and diversity and underrepresented populations, it starts early. So having programs where we're getting kids in the lab, mm-hmm. you know, having mm-hmm. programs where we're getting medical students to understand what we do as a field. I think that's what it's going to take. That's why I like to tell people, because I used to kind of people, and then also getting rid of some of these stereotypes that people have about pathology. And I think that's not just right. about a minority thing, but people think that, you know, you can't be social, you know, but it's such an amazing field and a lot of amazing people. And then when they mm-hmm. come down to the department, they're like, it's great down here, you know?
Yeah.
So dispelling some of those myths of the culture of pathology, I think that's huge too. And that's kind of, I really think that's why I love Path Twitter. And I tell people to get on Path Twitter because right. you just see all of these amazing people showing what they love, and we're laughing, we're making jokes. And it's just like, hey, we're real people. We're not just stuck behind a microscope, and understanding that we're not by ourselves in the lab. We deal with a lot of people on a daily basis. You know, we communicate a lot.
I was going to add on top of that, like, yeah, so for those med students who are in their third and fourth year in surgery and you come to the PATH labs, look at slides, you know, take a seat. Take the seat and look at the slides with us. At least so you're
yes.
off your feet yes. a bit.
Exactly. Know, come in this frozen room and sit down.
Right, sit down. You know, we'll get you some, like, hot cocoa. There was, like, one of the ophthalmologists, that's Dr. G is what I'm going to call him because I'm going to mess up his name, that made this whole funny mm-hmm. tweet about, like, pathologists in the labs and getting the students hot yeah. cocoa. mm-hmm. We'll get you some hot cocoa,
that.
Babies.
I think I put it on my Facebook. Yeah. I put it on my Facebook. That was so good.
We'll get you some hot cocoa, sit down, relax, we'll talk to you through the slide, and, you know, come join us anytime. And mm-hmm. you talked mm-hmm. about Path Twitter, so the final question is, how are ways or people can follow you to see how your career progresses through social media platforms such as Twitter? What are, like, your Twitter
so,
names and stuff?
I'm on Path Twitter as at Melanin, M-E-L-A-N-I-N. Path MD, PATHMD. I've also in the process of kind of like starting like a kind of like a Facebook group or like an online community about kind of like health advocacy. That's something that I'm working on, hopefully to have soon, so people understand what their diagnosis is and mm-hmm. the right questions to ask when they go to the doctor. So I think that's important, these paths. And I've learned, and that's one thing that I learned from like being in like these endometriosis support groups, is that people will post their PATH report. Like, what does this mean about, you know, this ligament and this soft tissue and all this stuff, or, you know, there are scans and these PATH reports and they have to wait a week and a half before they're like, what does this mean? And I'm like, I would love to tell you, I can't, but right. you know, just the need for that space. And I think that's one thing that I'd like to help with. But I'm on Twitter and I'm working on that. So hopefully I'll have information on that on my Twitter. Also, you can see me on the Louisville pathology website, and I work a lot with the DEI office as well as that. So sometimes you can see posts from the Office of Diversity and Inclusion that I'll help with, as well as I help with all of the, as well as the University of Louisville PATH. Like, I help with some of the posts and stuff that they make. We also have a University of Louisville pathology page where we highlight a lot of what we're doing in the department, and we're doing a lot with digital pathology, which I'm really excited about. So you can find that on the University of Louisville Pathology Department website. So if you just Google, like, or in Facebook, University of Louisville Pathology, our Facebook page will pop up. And we also have the UL Pathology. I think it's U_L Pathology is our Twitter account. And we're getting more active on that. But you can find me in those places. And if you just reach out to me, you can send me a DM. I love to, if you want to vent or you just want to share or just connect, I'm open for that. I think it's a great space for that.
Awesome. And then, do you have any final words for the audience before we head off?
I think it's important for people to find your place, find your niche, and be comfortable in that. There's a lot that you'll see in social media, and, you know, people will say a lot of things if you say that you're interested in pathology. But I like to put myself out there to, in a way, to also educate people about what I do, because a lot of people are just misinformed. So I just love to make it fun whenever I can, but I'm also proud of what I do, and I like to share that. I just encourage anybody that's a resident or that's you know, even for attendings, just to, you know, if they know somebody that's a med student or a high school student, just to have them come hang out. I've had people come hang out with me that's a first year, second year. They heard what I do. I just tell them to come, or if we're doing a hospital autopsy and you've signed all your HIPAA stuff, come in. And some people have just spent like an hour or two with me, or they'll spend the day, or they'll come do their electives with me. And I've spoken to my department. You can speak to your department to say, hey, if people want to shadow with me, how can we do that, you know, outside of elective time, rotation time? So that's a really a great way that I've been able to have students connect, is through they'll see me as I'm active at the university, and they'll be like, hey, can I come spend some time with you? And it doesn't even have to be a lot of time, but they'll come and hang out with me. So they see that relaxed environment. And so I just encourage that for other people to just say, if you have the time, you make the time for it, it really makes all the difference. And also when you have those students, to also encourage them in the process, especially if it's a minority or underrepresented population, to just give them, you know, encourage them along the way too. So that's my little way to get them into pathology, but also say, hey, you can do this. So it serves two purposes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today for the Diversifying Path podcast. Really appreciated your honesty and your sharing and the strength that you have given us along the way. So thank you so much for being a part of this.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for having this platform and bringing up these very important conversations. I mean, if we don't talk about it, we can't solve these issues. We can't, you know, bring attention to them. So I really applaud you for this. And thank you for also sharing your experiences, because as you're, you know, pretty much an upper level to me, it's encouraging to see you on your path and to see what you're doing. It gives me comfort to know that, hey, I can do it too. So thank you for being open and being who you are, and just being influential.
Thank you. All right. Hi again, friends. Well, this is it for today's episode. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to listen to the Diversifying Path podcast. Hope you enjoyed the episode, and I hope to see you soon.